Back here on Downtown on a Wednesday afternoon, and it's time for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt here. In a book that we've talked about a couple of times called Speed Capital, Indianapolis Auto Racing and the Making of Modern America. We're joined by the author, Brian Ingrassia. Brian, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the program. I appreciate it.
We love the book so much, and we always love, we were just talking about it before the show, always love it when we learn things that we didn't know before, and boy, your book is chock full of information like that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
One of the things, Brian, that I really wanted to know is, how did you first stumble on Carl Fisher? I think I know a little bit about sports, and I think I know a little bit about highways and the like. But he is so important in many ways, and yet I never even heard his name.
Yeah, you know, the way I came up with the topic was I was at the University of Illinois finishing up my my dissertation. I was writing about college football and college football stadiums. And what I had done is I had done about a 6 or 7 week research trip to New England. I was in Boston area doing research. And I just kind of wanted to be, you know, back in cities. And Champaign-Urbana is not Boston, as you can probably imagine.
Yeah.
And so a couple times I would go over to Indianapolis and just kind of look around and do, you know, city stuff. And then one day I was over by the Speedway, and I realized that the Speedway is in a place called Speedway, but it originally started out as Speedway City, Indiana. And I said, wow, I want to know the history of this place. Why is there a city with a racetrack that's organized around speed? And I said, I need to go read the best thing anybody's ever written about this place. And I discovered that didn't exist. And I said, well, I better go read about the best thing anybody's ever read, best academic thing anybody's ever read about the Speedway. And nobody had done that either. And so I just kind of started doing some exploring, and I discovered this Carl Fisher guy. And kind of like you, I didn't know who he was. I'd never heard of this person. I'd heard of Henry Ford, but not Carl Fisher. And one of the funny things about Fisher is that as much of a kind of, you know, somebody who loved to build things, he didn't like to name things after himself. You know, when people would say, oh, we should name this after you, or we should build a statue to you, he's like, no, we don't need that. And so even though I think he's this incredibly important figure for cities and highways and auto racing, all this stuff, we don't hear his name the same way we do Henry Ford. And I think, you know, I like to say he's as important as Henry Ford. That may be a bit of an exaggeration, but he's certainly a very important person for how we as Americans use automobiles and think about automobiles and those kinds of things.
Well, I would say every bit as much of a visionary as Ford was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, Henry Ford, he was a great businessman, I think, and a great mechanic, and he figured out a way to make lots of cars that we could buy and we could use. But, you know, Carl Fisher figured out ways to teach us how to enjoy those cars by building highways and racetracks and resort towns that people could drive to, like Miami Beach, right? That he's very much this visionary who doesn't just say, well, how can I build a car, but how can I convince people that cars can be fun and I can enjoy them and use them and so forth?
Yeah, and I would argue, I realize that you know, Eisenhower was behind the interstate, but if he hadn't seen some of what Fisher had mm-hmm. done in creating public highways with private money, I don't know that we would have seen this explosion in car travel and the like. And in a sense, as much as the railroad, he opened up the West to the Midwest.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, between the Lincoln Highway that Fisher proposes, I think around 1912 or so, and then the Dixie Highway around 1913, it's right there in the early 19-teens. And yeah, you're right, Fisher did not like public funding. He didn't want the government to come in and take over his highways, but he kind of gets the ball rolling to the point where by about 1916 or so, I think, you know, there are members of Congress who are saying, well, we need federal funding, right? If we're going to have these big automobile networks, we need to have the government step in and do some of this funding. And I think you're absolutely right. Those early highways establish a precedent where people realize I can drive from, you know, Chicago out to Wyoming, or, you know, I can drive from New York out to Indiana, or I can drive from Indiana down to Florida in a way that before the 19-teens, if you want to drive not just across country, if you want to drive to the next state over, you're going to have incredibly detailed instructions and advice and maps. And the highway system that's built after the 19-teens, especially the black and white shielded U.S. highways built in the 1920s, I think those very much draw on Fisher, but they also change the way we look at space and how quickly we can go from one place to another place.
Well, and one of the things that Fisher did in establishing the Speedway and making a place to test cars was he put America at the forefront of automobile manufacturing, you know, eventually ahead of the Brits, ahead of the French, ahead of the Italians. Yeah. And so in a sense, Indianapolis is as important as Detroit in the history of automobiles and I'd say transportation in the U.S. If you'd have told me that even 5 years ago, I would have said, oh, come on, Indianapolis, really?
Yeah, you know, Indianapolis is in this weird place. I think, you know, Detroit has very much a claim to being the kind of car city. But Indianapolis in the early 1900s is a very important secondary place for the production of automobiles. Still today, Indiana is an important place for manufacturing auto parts. Part of that, my understanding, is that, you know, Detroit has water transportation, which Indianapolis doesn't have. It's a landlocked city, essentially. It's got railroads, but it doesn't have, you know, the Great Lakes. And so Detroit is a better place for manufacturing cars, and it eventually wins out. But Indianapolis, still a good place for manufacturing smaller parts. But it also, what I try to argue in the book, is that Indianapolis figures out there's other ways to make money off of cars besides just building cars and selling them. You can also sell people on the spectacle, right? You can create a place that people can drive to, and they can watch cars go really fast. And by the post-World War II period, it also becomes very much a place for nostalgia, right? This is a place where we can talk not just about the races that's happening today, but the races that happened 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago. And sport very much, I think we see this in sports like baseball too, right? Sport very much becomes about nostalgia as much as it is about the actual thing happening in front of you. And I think Fisher kind of creates that sense of, like, you know, automobiles are about spectacle, and then later on Indianapolis realizes, okay, we can capitalize on the spectacle and the nostalgia of the spectacle that's happened now for, what, about 115 years or so there in Indianapolis.
We're talking with Brian Ingrassi about his book, Speed Capital. So many wonderful stories in the book. I especially loved the idea Fisher had that the infield at the Speedway would be a great place to get the ponies in and play polo.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what happens is after World War One, they realize that the Speedway, it's a brick track built in 1909. It's not quite good enough for the kinds of speeds that we're seeing after World War One. I mean, they're starting to use aviation motors in some of these cars. And, you know, Daytona Beach is a much better place to set a speed record than the bricks at Indianapolis. And so he's trying to find ways to diversify. You know, he puts in a polo field. You know, I think he would be totally open to the idea of just tearing the place down and turning it into a development. But eventually, over time, they do realize, oh, there's money to be made here in ways that aren't just cars, right? And in the early years of the race, they're doing balloon contests there. They're doing aviation contests. And, yeah, polo is just another one of those ways that Fisher, you know, he's like the P.T. Barnum of Indiana, right? He's like, how can we create a spectacle that's going to, first of all, people are going to enjoy it, but also we can make money off of it. It's all about making money.
One of the things that really struck me about the whole thing with the Speedway was the urban planning part of it. That they're going to build a town, and it's going to be the perfect town to commute from. It's going to have all these advantages, and it's very progressive. There are going to be health care facilities, and there are going to be schools for the kids and all this kind of stuff. It may have been a sunset town, which may speak to things about Fisher that otherwise yeah. wouldn't be so apparent. I mean, it didn't seem to be so overtly racist. And you do a great job with discussing that in the book. Mm-hmm. But I think of so much that's gone on in the East Coast that if it had the congestion we have in the 95 corridor, we wouldn't have today if that model had been available before Boston and Philadelphia and Richmond and New York and all those cities were sort of glommed along the I-95 corridor. How big an effect do you think in the long run that thinking of his had on American city planning?
Yeah, well, and he's not the only person to come up with the idea of what we call welfare capitalism, right? The idea that, I mean, Henry Ford does this too. You know, you create towns where, you know, workers, especially white workers, can have nice houses and schools and healthcare and all that stuff. But certainly Speedway is one of those places, and you're absolutely right. As far as we can tell, it was a sundown town. Basically, you know, if you're not white, you can't be there after the sun goes down. I grew up in a very similar town in central Illinois, so I'm not throwing any stones here. But yeah, I think, you know, thinking about the East Coast is that we, you know, those cities that you mentioned are very much cities that so much of their growth happened before automobiles. You know, I mean, think of a city like Boston, right? Which is, you know, it's a 17th century city that, you know, has highways going through it. And what happens is that at a certain point in time, I think so much urban infrastructure in the United States gets switched to automobiles. And some of the places that see a lot of 20th century growth are places that are either early adopters of the automobile or kind of figure out ways to build themselves around automobiles. Now, that can also be a problem. I live in a city in Texas that didn't exist before 1887. And, you know, the first car shows up in 1904. And it's this incredibly sprawling city because it's so much focused around automobiles. It's really convenient to get around with an automobile, but you can't walk it very well. There's no trains. You know, I miss that about Boston, right, is that you can get on the T and go where you need to go. But the flip side of that is, yeah, if you've got a car and you're trying to drive around the metro area, it makes it a lot harder because a lot of the infrastructure does predate automobiles. And I think Fisher was a visionary in the sense that he realized we might get to a point in the United States where people are driving everywhere. And so we want to have highways and such that are designed for automobiles.
Well, and the whole westward movement during the Dust Bowl would have been even more difficult to journey than it was if it hadn't been for what had happened in those prior two decades.
Yeah, I mean, we think a big part of the legend of Route 66 is the westward migration during the Dust Bowl. And, of course, 66 is one of those 1920s highways, U.S. highways built in the 19-teens and 1920s, that kind of follows the model of the Lincoln Highway, which Fisher then had proposed back in the 19-teens.
Well, one of the last things I know you want to mention is a little bit about the museum, the Speedway Museum. I'm unfamiliar with it, and the one time I was in Indianapolis, I didn't go there, so next time I will.
Yeah, the museum, they first propose it, and I think it's the late 40s, early 50s. For your listeners who maybe don't know, the Speedway was originally built by Fisher. He and his business partner sell it in 1927 to the World War I hero, aviator Eddie Rickenbacker. Rickenbacker's probably a front for a group of General Motors investors based out of Detroit, but he is at least nominally the owner. And then by World War II, you know, they don't have races during World War II, and it looks like they're just going to bulldoze the track. They're going to turn into a housing, post-World War II housing development. And what happens essentially is a racer who had won several races right before World War II, a guy named Wilbur Shaw comes along and says, you know, we need to save this place. He says, it's too legendary. It's too important. We need to save it. He finds an investor in Terre Haute, Indiana, Tony Holman. Some of your listeners, again, may know that name. Tony Holman then says, okay, I'm going to buy this track, 1945, and I'm going to put a bunch of money into it. And it's he and Wilbur Shaw in the years just after World War II. They say, you know, we should have a museum here. And they start tracking down old cars and old photographs, and they create the museum by the 1950s. Now, the facility that's currently there within the infield, I think they built that in about 1976 or so. It's a beautiful museum. I highly recommend that you go there if you're in Indianapolis. I did some of my research there at that museum. But I also do think that what's interesting is that this is another case of those, you know, by the mid-20th century, sports are realizing that they can make money and they can spread their story not just through games now, but through nostalgia. You know, the Baseball Hall of Fame is established in the 1930s. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum is the 1950s. Eventually we have, you know, football halls of fame and things like that. And so I think that it's a really good example of kind of how it's the cultural logic of sports capitalism, that eventually sports leagues essentially, or sporting events, realize that the value of their brand is not just in the actual events that they're selling to people, but kind of the story and the nostalgia they're selling. And that's something I talk about a little bit there towards the end of the book. But I think it takes the idea that the Speedway starts as this place for demonstrating these new technologies, and eventually kind of it almost becomes obsolete. And so they figure out a different way of marketing.
Well, this is a really good book.
The value of it.
It's a really good book, Brian. We've really enjoyed it, and I thank you for joining us today. Just remind people that it is from the University of Illinois Press, Speed Capital, Indianapolis Auto Racing, and the Making of Modern America. You will learn more from reading this book than you could possibly imagine. And again, thank you for being with us, and I hope we'll talk to you again sometime down the line about your history of gridiron.
Awesome. Thank you. I'd love to talk to you about that, too.
All right.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Ingrassia with us, the book,